Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fergal Byrne. Every fortnight, I speak to scientists and economists, NGO leaders, grassroots activists and environmentalists, business executives and investors, a mix of conventional and unconventional voices, exploring diverse perspectives, practical solutions, and critical thinking about the environmental crisis we are facing. Save the Children has been providing essential services and support to Palestinian children impacted by the ongoing conflict since 1953 and have had a permanent presence in the occupied Palestinian territory since 1973. Right now, children are under increasing emotional and psychological pressure as they bear the brunt of the world's worsening crisis. For years, Save the Children has responded to the unique needs of children impacted by conflict and displacement. Your donation to the Children's Emergency Fund helps support this life-saving work. Please support Save the Children Gaza campaign at savethechildren.org and click on Emergencies link. Your donation will support Save the Children's urgent humanitarian relief efforts in Gaza. Welcome to this special episode of the Sustainability Agenda in collaboration with my daughter, Catherine Byrne, who is co-hosting this episode. Catherine is a forest researcher working with evolving forests in Devon, England, and a woodlab fellow at Hook Park in Dorset. She is also host of a radio show on Ballamy Radio based around her nature-based field recordings, some of which are included in this episode. I'm very pleased today to welcome Owen Dalton to the podcast. Owen is an Irish farmer and an outspoken advocate for rewilding. He runs a farm and rewilding project on the Beara Peninsula of County Cork. Owen is the author of an acclaimed book on his personal rewilding work on the Beara Peninsula, an Irish Atlantic rainforest, a personal journey into the magic of rewilding. By background and training, a conservator of sculpture and a sculptor in stone, this extended interview took place on Owen's farm in Aries on the Beara Peninsula. So thank you very much, Owen, for joining me today on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
My absolute pleasure, Fergal. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I'm very much looking forward to talking to you about the great work you're doing here, the forest, the rewilding, and some of your other projects as well. So before we begin, can you maybe just tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what you do here?
Sure, happy to. So I'm from Dublin, as most people will be able to tell, certainly any Irish people. I'm from Dublin. I've lived in several different countries. I had a fairly diverse experience of life, but in 2009, I sold the cottage, the 18th century cottage that I'd rebuilt in Kilmainham, Dublin, and with my family used the proceeds to buy a small 73-acre farm on the north side of the Beara Peninsula near Irees, and moved down here and have been living here ever since. And what attracted me to this particular place was, I guess, to begin with, were the absolutely spectacular views out over the Atlantic taking in seven different islands, including the Skelligs. And to the east, there are you can see the McGillicuddy Reeks, including Carán Tuil. But far more than that was the actual land itself here. And when I say that, so what you have here, the farm is incredibly varied topographically in terms of, sheer escarpments, cliffs, deep gorges with rushing streams coming down off the mountain, rocky scree, boulders. It's a hugely stimulating landscape geologically and topographically. But overlying all that, you've got the most wonderful forest, wild native forest, that didn't come here because somebody decided, let's have a forest here. It happened because the land was left unfarmed and the trees grew by themselves. So it's a wild, it's not just a native forest, it's wild. And I absolutely just fell in love with the place from the moment I laid eyes on it, and have been ever since.
It's the project of many years. You've been here, 14 years?
Getting on for 15.
Yes. Before we discuss what you've done here and the philosophy and some of the results from your rewilding here, and maybe discussing a little bit rewilding itself, can we just set the scene a little bit? Obviously, we're in the middle of various interrelated crises at the moment, no shortage of environmental crises as well. What's on your mind, particularly when you think about the environment, climate, and so forth? What worries you the most, would you say, Owen?
I think we are in the midst of an absolute perfect storm in terms of the ecological crisis that we're in. People are more and more becoming aware of the gravity of climate breakdown, but they're less aware of what, to my mind, is an equally, if not more serious, emergency, which is the loss of natural ecosystems and the species that make them up across the planet. And Ireland is one of the worst affected countries on the whole planet in that regard. And while there are hopeful signs, there are, I think more and more people are waking up to how bad things are. We're still not where we need to be. We're still not getting that critical mass of people saying, this needs to change right now. So that is worrying. So to take an example, we've seen absolutely disastrous flooding in Middleton and other parts of Southern Ireland. But very few people are joining the dots and saying that that is the inevitable result of essentially eliminating all natural habitat from the island of Ireland and replacing it with artificial landscapes of sheep or cattle pasture or Sitka spruce forests or built up environments. These are all artificial landscapes. And, the consequences of just getting rid of all of the natural ecosystems that were here and replacing them with something else that we think suits us are multiple, and flooding is just one of them. And people have yet to understand that. They've yet to connect their actions with the inevitable consequences that we're starting to see now, which which include flooding, but so many other results, including the collapse of a stable climate.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. And obviously, this has gone on since thousands of years, the deforestation, for example, in Ireland and so forth, and back in history. Much of it also influenced by agriculture, I suppose, and approaches to agriculture and farming, feeding the population and so forth. Can you talk a little bit about that in the Irish context? Have you any general observations about the way in which Irish farming would have impacted the landscape?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting to take a specific area like this area, or the more widely the Bear Peninsula, as a kind of a microcosm for understanding what happened in a much more widespread, on a much more widespread level. So if you dig down deep into the ecological prehistory of this particular area, what you find is that Beara was essentially all forested up until several thousand years ago. So its natural original state is thick wild forest, which would have been composed of thousands of different species, all intimately connected ecologically. In pre-farming times, i.e. the Mesolithic, you would have had hunter-gatherer people moving through the landscape and living off it through hunting some of the animals that would have been living here in those ecosystems, and fishing and foraging for berries and nuts and so on. And their impact would have been relatively light, because they would have been few in number and they wouldn't have been here on a constant basis. They would have just moved through the landscape. Farming arrived with the Neolithic, and you're talking roughly about 4000 BC in this part of the world. What farming was a complete revolution in terms of how we impacted the landscape, because rather than just, you know, passing through, what farming did was it farming takes land and it completely transforms it to become productive of food for us. So, you know, while the farming that was practiced back then would have been it would have been much less impactful on nature than many of the types of farming that are practiced now, it was a complete change, because, you know, it meant getting rid of the forests that were here or other natural habitats and replacing them with pasture, or to a far more limited extent, cereal growing. So you were essentially pushing out most species to turn the land into something that produced food for one species, which is us. And that started to happen on the Bear Peninsula, as I said, you know, in the Neolithic. But those societies weren't, they interestingly enough, what seems to have happened was that the society in this part of the world that was doing that only lasted for about 1,000 years, and then they had to leave. Now, most of the evidence seems to suggest that was due to a collapse of the environmental conditions that allowed them to survive. So they had to, as a result of the farming that they were practicing. Yeah. So they had to move away. And that allowed the forest and the nature and the other types of ecosystems to return naturally.
Yeah.
And people didn't come back until around the Bronze Age. And that was when it was in the Bronze Age that this particular part of Beara first started to be farmed and the forest started to be cleared. So you're talking around 1500 BC. And from that moment on around here, and the palynological evidence is very clear on this. Palynological means the study of pollen deposits taken from cores of peat and so on. It shows that there was a steady decrease of natural forest in the area down to the present day. But what was interesting about that was that it wasn't linear. It wasn't a kind of a steady, it wasn't a decline that went in one direction only. It was like a series of collapses and recoveries. As I mentioned, what happened post-Neolithic farming, that repeated itself, whereby you had the people arrived, you had a collapse of forest levels, followed by a partial return of the forests. You had a whole series of these events, but the overall trajectory was downwards. And so we in Ireland have been, you know, given, many of us have been given this narrative that it was the English who came and cut down Ireland's forests. And that's largely, well, it's very much a simplification, an oversimplification of what happened. But there's a lot of truth in it as well, because what you have is that is a situation in which by about 1600, most of the forest was already gone. Post 1600, you had an acceleration by the colonial power that was increasingly taking control of the land in Ireland. And they saw the remaining pockets of forest as refuges for native Irish resistance. And they also saw, you know, their position in the land was insecure, these new colonial landowners. So their interest was in making quick cash out of the timber that was in the forests and also turning it into agricultural land that had more value and depriving the native Irish resistance plus wolves and the like of places where they could use as refuges. So for a whole number of different reasons, they were far more aggressive in getting rid of what was left than you know the society that previously existed. But again, just to repeat, most of the forest was already gone before that last process started. And I would think that rather than the trees being cut down in both periods, what you had, I mean, obviously cutting down the trees was a part of it. But I think that, you know, if you go into the forest that I have here with a stone axe or even a bronze axe and you try to make an impact on it, you know, you'll have your heart broken very quick, I would imagine. So I think that the way that people mostly got rid of the forests wasn't through cutting down the trees. It was through putting their animals, their grazing livestock into the forests. Those animals, whether it's sheep, cattle, goats, preventing the natural regeneration of the trees by eating every last seedling. And over the course of hundreds of years, the forest would have just died away through not being able to reproduce. I think that's how we lost most of our forests in Ireland.
I guess the ongoing farming structure of the farming in Ireland is a big topic, and we can come to that maybe a little bit later. I'm just maybe wondering, Catherine, if you wanted to start there as well with it. I mean, it wasn't a question we necessarily started with. You can just want to start talking about the actual project.
So yeah, so I guess just then you were mentioning of talking about this idea of the grazing animals coming in and kind of destroying the forest. And that probably links quite well into what you've done here and your project with this forest. So do you want to talk a little bit and tell us about how, when you arrived here, what was your vision and how you went about doing that?
Sure. So when I arrived in, the first time I saw the forest was in 2008 when I visited it, and it was on the market. And what I found was this absolutely mesmerizingly beautiful forest, full of oaks and hazel and birch and holly and rowan and all the rest of it, about a dozen different tree species in all. But it was in an absolutely desperate ecological state. And there were several sides to that, but they all stemmed really from severe overgrazing. Mm-hmm. So what had happened was that the family who lived here in the past, the Crowleys, they mostly emigrated to the United States in the early 20th century. And the result of that was, for, interestingly, it seems like it was exactly a century. So the main guy, Phil Crowley, emigrated to Butte, Montana. He was an Alahees copper miner. And he the copper mine closed, and he emigrated, it looks like, around 1909, which was exactly a century before we arrived in 2009, wow, coincidentally. And from that moment on, the land was very little used agriculturally. And what that allowed was I think if you went back to Phil Crowley's time, what you would have found would have been what you generally see in neighboring farms now, which is mostly pasture for sheep and or cattle, but with pockets here and there where the land is rougher, where you have scree or very rocky ground or cliffs or gorges. Those areas are seen as being pretty much worthless for nature, for farming, and are therefore left to nature. And those places serve as kind of refuges, not just for the trees, but all of the associated biodiversity, all of the ground flora, if it's not being too heavily overgrazed, but also all of the ferns, the mosses, the lichens, the invertebrates, the birds, the mycorrhizal fungi, the whole lot. And what happened here in the Crowley place was that after Phil went to the United States, those pockets were able to start spreading out because the grazing pressure was largely lifted. Now, the Crowleys did have a few cattle down through the years, but they used to range out across the whole area. I heard lots of stories about the Crowley, Eileen Crowley's famous cows. So I think that their pressure on this particular farm would have been very, very light, if not non-existent. So you had the forest colonizing out through self-seeding, and all of the rest of the ecosystem following it. Mm-hmm. And essentially taking over most of the farm. And that's what attracted me to the place. However, about 10 or maybe 15 years before we moved down here, some people who had been living in the area and then moved on, and they had goats. And when they left, they released the goats. Now, I think you're only talking about a tiny handful, maybe three or four goats. But those goats started to reproduce and reproduce and reproduce until in this immediate area, you had about 100 goats.
Wow.
And they had a range of probably a couple of square kilometers, but their central hangout was our farm, the forest that had developed in our farm. And the effect of these goats, and the other thing is that there are sika deer in the area. Sí Cá Dhiar were introduced to this part of Ireland by Lord Lansdowne in the 1860s, and they, again, similarly to the goats, but going back much further, they started to reproduce and to spread out from there. And both species fit all of the criteria of what you would ecologically describe as invasive species. They're non-native, they're extremely damaging to ecosystems, and they are what we would call invasive species. And the effect that they were having, the sika and the goats were having, on the forest that had developed here on the farm was multifold. So the first effect was to prevent all natural regeneration of the trees themselves. So there were no trees younger than about 10 or 15 years on the land. They'd also completely stripped out all of the very rich ground flora that you should have in such a forest. All of this, all of the flowers and most of the ferns and all of the other plants that you should have there. That was just completely gone. All you had left on the ground layer were several non-palatable plants like bracken and the mosses and one or two others, almost nothing else. The goats and sika were also, had been stripping the bark off a lot of the older trees, which if it extends all the way around the tree, kills the tree, because the bark is like a kind of a highway between the roots of the tree and the canopy for bringing down the products of photosynthesis from the leaves down to the roots, and for water and all sorts of other nutrients from the roots up to the leaves. So if the bark is stripped all the way around, the tree dies. And so the forest was absolutely just littered with dead trees. On top of that, the severe overgrazing had created the absolutely ideal conditions for invasive plant species to start taking over. And the same people who released the goats also planted a lot. They planted about 8 or 9 different invasive plant species. It's nearly like they had a kind of a checklist of all of the worst ones and made sure that they had all of those in there. So you had Chilean myrtle, bamboo,
wow,
Ambrosia, sycamore, gunnera, and several others, the Japanese knotweed.
Mm-hmm.
But the worst of the whole lot is rhododendron ponticum. And they had planted a lot of rhododendron in their places. It's about an acre that adjoins this farm. And that, all of these, because of the overgrazing, there was no competition in the form of the native native vegetation. That was all just gone. So that creates the ideal conditions for all the rhododendron and all of these other invasive plant species to start moving in. So that's essentially what I had here when I arrived, was this absolutely gorgeous wild forest that was in ecological meltdown. So what I did is I applied for a scheme called the Native Woodland Scheme to fund the erection of a fence around most of the forest to fence out the goats and the sika. And I set to work in my spare time getting rid of the rhododendron and all the other invasive plants. After about a year and a half, the application was approved for the fencing, and some contractors came in and put up a fence around 21 and a half acres. And over the following few years, and ever since, I've been seeing just the most incredible renaissance and transformation of the land as a result of these actions. The whole land has just absolutely blossomed. So what that means in practice is that trees that germinated, tree seedlings, little oaks and rowans and wild apple and ash and all the rest, they've started to form new forests in areas that were previously just barren, what you'd call Finnan grass down here. It's Molinia or purple moorgrass. And you had a lot of open areas where there was no forest, and they have started to revert naturally into wild native forest. Also within the existing forest itself, scores of wildflowers just erupted everywhere. I thought that they weren't there at all. I didn't realize. I thought that they mustn't be there. Bluebell, wood anemone, lesser celandine, herb robert, sanicle, wood sorrel, enchanter's nightshade, dog violet, marsh violet, and scores of others.
Yeah.
All just the woodland floor just came alive with all of this life. You know, the trees that were here started to change in the sense that what you had previously due to the overgrazing was just a very minimalist bare trunk.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with the withdrawal of the overgrazing, they started to send out basal shoots and they started to send out new growth mm-hmm. from low down. And so the existing trees started to transform themselves. And all of this, of course, created the conditions for a huge boon in all of the other faunal life of the forest. So all of the insects and then, you know, all of the things that eat the insects and so bird life and even extending to several rare and protected native mammal species moving in. The first of which were lesser horseshoe bats, which are pretty rare internationally. And there's a colony of this species now here, which has been growing ever since. Also pine martens turned up relatively recently, only about 3 years ago, they started to show up. And they're now resident in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And otters have started to, I saw one once and I've since seen them several times on camera trap videos. And they're obviously, they kind of tend to stay around the streams.
Yeah.
But I think just all of these enhanced ecological conditions have been attractive to these species. And no doubt lots of others that I'm less aware of, like I've started sparrowhawks are nesting in the woods. I know that there are barn owls, and I'm sure there's lots of other stuff that I'm aware of. So there's just been this incredible, you know, it's been such a joy to see all this happen, you know, an indescribable joy. But I guess the other side, the flip side of that joy is a deep pain that comes from seeing the degree of contrast between what's possible and how completely ecologically trashed the wider Irish landscape is. And it really is. You know, I've spent a lot of the last summer giving talks about my book, which came out last year. All over Ireland, I've been giving, you know, a lot of talks. And that means traveling all around Ireland. And I've been making a point of visiting fragments of native forest everywhere I've gone from, you know, right from the north coast of Antrim to Donegal, down through Sligo, Galway, Clare, and the east coast as well. And it's so depressing, you know, to find these places means driving for 4 or 5 hours across the country to find this tiny little sliver. And you're driving through a landscape that's all just farmland. Ireland has essentially been turned into one big farm and an increasingly industrialized one where all other nature and life has been pushed out to the maximum extent. So you're driving across this expanse of almost nothingness, of just sheep or cattle grazed pasture, which is as likely as not to be just one species of perennial ryegrass, or in the uplands of purple moorgrass, the Fennan I mentioned earlier, interrupted only by blocks of Sitka spruce or built up areas. And to find a tiny little remnant of native forest, which is almost certainly completely trashed in the same way as my place was mm-hmm. when I arrived. It's such a bleak picture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of the scientific data tells us that nature in Ireland is in a desperate state. Mm-hmm. So just to give your listeners one example, which I repeat often, but, you know, there are so many other examples that can be given, but maybe this one just, you know, contextualizes what we're talking about here more starkly than some of the other the metrics that you could give. In 2018, the Natural History Museum of London drew up what they called a Global Biodiversity Intactness Index of all 240 nations and states on the planet, and ranked them according to how nature was doing in those places. Out of 240, Ireland came 13th from the bottom. And that comes, you know, that, and again, it's important to repeat that that is not anomalous in terms of what it's telling us. All of the data is saying the same thing, which is that things could hardly be worse here for nature. And yet they are actually getting worse right now because of the our choices in terms of land use and so on. And it comes as a shock to many people to hear this, because people assume that because Ireland is still a green country, you know, a field of Italian ryegrass grazed by cattle or sheep, you may only have two species mm-hmm. and very little else in there beyond the ryegrass and the cattle, but it still looks green. So people are fooled into thinking that we have this lush green countryside. Ireland is increasingly an ecological desert.
Mm-hmm. So I guess what could be interesting to talk about now is actually the concept of rewilding. So that's, you know, I guess rewilding is how you would describe the process that you've been working at here.
Yeah.
But it's obviously quite a complex and multifaceted idea with kind of variations within it. And I was wondering if you could give an overview of the different approaches of rewilding as you understand them, and what's your specific approach to rewilding, and that kind of underlying philosophy, as it were.
Well, I think, you know, you can make something as complicated as you want to. And I'm not sure that there's an awful lot to gain from doing that. I mean, the essential core idea of rewilding is pretty straightforward. And what it means is giving space back to wild nature. And that can be on land, but it can be in the sea as well. So maybe it can actually be useful to start off by talking about the sea. So like all of the, everything I've just said about the state of nature in Ireland is equally valid for the sea, which has been absolutely wrecked by overfishing, overexploitation of all sorts. We know that if you establish a properly protected marine protected area, that the result of that, now what that means is that nobody can go in there and do any fishing, no trawling, no lobster pots, no mining of the seabed. You just leave it absolutely alone for nature. That these areas, and this has been found all over the world, these marine protected areas quickly become absolutely chock-a-block again with marine life, of all of the fish, all of the other things that live there, all of the things that the fish eat, the whole lot, all very quickly comes back, and that then starts spilling out into the non-protected areas. So even for fishermen, it's a hugely beneficial thing, because they end up with more to fish. And that is, in a sense, rewilding a marine area. The exact same goes for land. If you stop exploiting an area, nature will come back, as I found in my place. Maybe the main difference between marine areas and the land is that often on land, I guess it's important to understand that, as we were saying earlier, terrestrial land-based ecosystems have been exploited and wrecked for a lot longer than at sea. So really our the extreme impacts at sea, I mean, we've been wrecking marine ecosystems for a long time as well, but it really started to only get intense within the last century or two. On land, it's been happening for thousands of years. So very often on land, you need to give nature a helping hand. You need to undo some of the damage we have done. So the examples of that are what I've already described in terms of what I've done, getting rid of the, preventing the overgrazing. Because you need to remember that such elevated densities of grazers, whether it's native ones or invasive ones like sika and goats, in either case, it's an artificial situation, which is a direct result of the fact that A, we got rid of, we drove to extinction all of the predator species that would naturally regulate both the numbers and the behavior of these grazers. And then B, to a degree, by bringing in several of the non-native invasive species, whether it's sika or goats or sheep or whatever, we brought those here. So these, you have to undo some of this damage, and then you just let nature get on with the rest.
Yeah, sounds like a very wonderful vision. And I'm just wondering about questions of that there's more hardcore visions of that, because in standing on its own, that all makes sense, but it's a farming country, there are economic concerns. And I'm wondering about how you adjust your thinking of rewilding when you're trying to integrate it into farming, or integrate farming into rewilding. The connection to people who are making their livelihood from generating food, producing food for local population and so forth, and the economics that underpin that. So maybe you can just talk a little bit about that. I guess it plays into complex questions as well, because it plays into land ownership and so forth and things like that. But talk a little bit about that.
No, it's really, really absolutely key question there that you've raised. I think it's essential to affirm from the get-go that rewilding will not happen unless it has the support and engagement of the people who live in the areas that we're talking about rewilding, which essentially means, you know, the more remote areas of Ireland, and Bear is a perfect example of that. If rewilding is seen as something that people who live in the city are trying to impose on people who live in places like this, it just won't happen. Simple as that. And if it were happening in that way, it's not just that it wouldn't happen, it would be deeply wrong. You know, it's not fair to impose stuff on people who are living in an area to come in and say, right, this is what you're doing from now on, whether you like it or not. It's wrong, and it's unfair, and it would backfire in terms of the very objectives that you're trying to achieve. The way to do it is to give people a choice in terms of livelihood options. So, for example, most farming around here is sheep farming because the land is rough. Sheep are the only thing that will live on the rougher parts of the land, which means all of the uplands and a lot of the lowlands as well. And sheep are an extremely, well, first off, they're a disaster ecologically because sheep are highly selective grazers. So the first thing they will eat are tree seedlings and other important flora. So I was discussing what's happening in a lot of my place now. If you put sheep in there, even if there's lots of grass and other stuff to eat, the first thing they will eat are the tree seedlings because they're extra, they're highly nutritious and therefore extra tasty, and the sheep will eat those out first, as well as all sorts of other highly important flora. And so sheep are an extremely effective way of keeping land in a highly ecologically degraded state. And that's what's happening over most of Beara and large parts of the West and other parts of Ireland. But sheep are also extremely uneconomic. Sheep farming really doesn't make any sense economically. The only reason why people are still doing it is because they're paid subsidies under the Common Agricultural Policy. Otherwise, it makes no sense. I had sheep for 5 years. So I know from direct experience that even with the subsidies, you barely break even. When you factor in fencing costs, which can be extremely high in a place like this, and shearing and all of the other things, all of the other costs that are involved, you barely break even, you know? So it makes absolutely no sense. However, I think it would be extremely wrong to come along and say to anybody, you need to get rid of your sheep, you need to start rewilding your land. What you do is you give farmers the option. You say to farmers, look, you know, if you want to carry on farming sheep, if you like running around in the lashing rain on a mountain after sheep, that's fine.
But you've got to get to the economic incentives underpinning it. And to what extent are those that are in Ireland today underpinned by what you're talking about in Europe? And you can say what you like to farmers, but if they're getting their money from doing one thing, how do you, presumably there's a changing the policy.
You need to give farmers the option of getting paid the same money to rewild their land as they are for ecologically trashing the land. And then let them decide.
And are we near that at all here? Is there any movement towards that?
We're moving in that direction, right. But it's not happening quickly enough. It is happening. So, for example, up until the 1st of January of this year, you had this ludicrous situation whereby if your farm was, for argument's sake, 90% grazed by sheep, and you had 10% that was scrub. And what is scrub? Let's just look at that for a moment. Scrub is wild natural habitat. So it's exactly what nature needs to be able to survive. You would be paid for your 90%.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be paid for that 10%. That 10% wasn't eligible and was therefore excluded from payments. And that was a direct incentive. It was pushing farmers to get rid of any remaining vestiges of wild nature that they had on their farm. That changed in the 1st of January this year.
Mm-hmm.
And farmers will now be paid for all of their land. But it needs to, regardless of whether they've got bits of scrub or rock or whatever else they have on their land, but it needs to change to give farmers the option of rewilding their land. And what I mean by that is not farming their land at all, because farming and rewilding, there are areas where high nature value farming, for example, can overlap with rewilding, but they are essentially two very different things.
What is high nature value farming?
High nature value farming is where you make a compromise between food production and allowing some nature, as much nature as possible, to survive within the parameters of what you have to do to achieve that food production.
Right.
But rewilding is something very different. Rewilding is about allowing natural processes to dominate. Natural processes are always going to be compromised to some degree where farming is a part of the equation of any sort, high nature value or otherwise.
Right.
So what we need to do is we need to say to farmers, look, you know, you've got this choice now. You can choose to carry on with the sheep or the cows or whatever, but there is this other option. You can be paid to just not farm your land in the same way, at the same amount. And we will pay you for all of that that land gives to society. Because, like, fundamentally here, what we have to recognize is that the land doesn't only serve to produce food or timber or wool or whatever else, or things that we need in as kind of consumables. It also, the land has so many other purposes, so many other things that it gives to us. Clean air, clean water, a stable climate, a functional biosphere, joy in our lives. And I'll just finish by saying this, that beyond all of that, beyond all the things that it gives us that aren't food or whatever.
So I'm quite interested in this idea of how we might be able to balance approaches such as rewilding with still producing the things that we need, such as food and timber. And for example, I work in a forest in Dorset called Hook Park, where we're trying to manage the forest sustainably for biodiversity, but also produce timber that provides an income for the forest. So this is it's a common challenge to try and work out, strike this balance between the more intensive and the less intensive kind of more balanced approaches. But this is kind of at the heart of this land sparing, land sharing argument, right? So can you give an overview of the different perspectives and what your views are within that kind of balance of land sparing, land sharing?
Happy to. I mean, again, it's a really good question, really important one. I think both land sparing and land sharing are both vital sides of the coin in terms of tackling ecological collapse while at the same time producing the things that we need to survive, whether it's food or timber or whatever. And you can talk about that in terms of farming. So, you know, setting aside forestry or forests for one moment, you know, I think there's, when it comes to farming and rewilding, we need high nature value farming and we need rewilding. They're both important. Now, for me, rewilding is a lot more important, but obviously we need to, it's a lot more important in terms of reversing ecological collapse, but obviously we need food. And so, you know, there is that as well, but that has to start happening in a highly nature-friendly way rather than this kind of sterile maximum productivity approach that's dominated up to now. And I think exactly the same approach applies to timber. So, for example, somewhere around 90% of Ireland's forests are, and I would put inverted commas around the word forest in that sense, because they really are. A forest for me is an ecosystem composed of thousands of species, all integrated with one another in ecological terms. 90% of what are described as forests in Ireland or very close to 90%, are plantations, most of which are Sitka. And these are completely and utterly barren. You would find as much nature in an urban car park, you know, if not more, actually. Sorry. No, I think you'd find more, because you'd have weeds and stuff growing up through the cracks. In a Sitka plantation, you will find almost nothing. Okay. And the impact, the ecological impact, extends beyond the plantation itself, because there you've got chemicals and the needles acidify the water. So the results are impacting on water courses and lakes and so on as well, and the wider environment. They're an utter disaster. But we're constantly told, yes, but we need this for timber, and they're a weapon against climate change, because they sequester carbon. All of this is completely false, and it's completely missing the bigger picture, which is, I mean, there are so many different levels that you could talk about this. I mean, the first one is that there's a lot of evidence that they actually don't sequester carbon when you factor in the amount of carbon that's lost during harvesting and thinning operations. They actually work out as being net carbon emitters. But putting that to one side, you know, a natural forest ecosystem sequesters vast amounts of carbon, but they do so much more than that. They natural forests regulate the climate in all sorts of other ways, through transpiring water, through absorbing moisture in times of flooding and releasing moisture in times of drought. On so many different levels, we have to start understanding that this planet is only has a habitable biosphere because of the ecosystems, the natural ecosystems that make up that biosphere. It will not be habitable if we transform those natural ecosystems into monoculture plantations, whether it's Highland ryegrass, Sitka spruce, Finan, Molinia grass, it doesn't matter. We have to start taking as our cue natural ecosystems again. So, which begs the question, well, is it possible to produce timber from natural ecosystems? Yes, it absolutely is. So one of the things that I find really interesting is that if you go and spend time in a Clearfeld Sitka plantation, one of the things that you will see are multitudes of wild native tree seedlings starting to come up all over the place. Birch, willow, holly, hazel, the whole lot. Particularly the pioneer species like birch and willow often, but also all of the others. Now, these get obliterated when that Clearfeld plantation is replanted, which they almost always are. But there's nothing to stop us just letting those develop to maturity, because those wild native trees are made of timber too. Now, obviously, you know, in a situation like that, you'd be leaving some purely for nature, where you wouldn't be exploiting them. The richer of them, the biologically richer of them, you'd say, right, we're just leaving those alone. Those are going to be left grow into old growth native forest ecosystems. Mm-hmm. Others, you would exploit, but in a very different way. There'd be no more clear felling. You'd take out trees here and there. Mm-hmm. Now, clearly, you'd need to do this on a much greater scale than, at the moment, around 11% of Ireland is covered by forests. If you call all of these plantations, if you lump all of those together with the tiny remaining fragments of native forest we have left, about 11% of Ireland is forested. Mm. That would need to expand massively to produce the timber we need in this alternative way. But that needs to happen anyway. We also need to be looking at other alternative ways of producing what currently comes from monoculture plantations, like, for example, hemp cultivation. So hemp is a crop that is much more productive for the same amount of land as a sitka plantation.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say off the top of my head how much more productive, but you know, you're talking about many, many multiples. And you can get from hemp many of the things like paper, pulp, and all sorts of things that currently come from monoculture plantations. And there are other alternatives that we need to be looking at. But the bottom line here is that we need to be thinking outside the box rather than saying, well, covering vast areas of land with dead zones is just the price we have to pay for timber. The very basis of that idea needs to become what it is, which is just, it's not acceptable.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, nature is a lovely word, isn't it? You can put it in front of anything and it sounds a lot better, you know, and we've got vast momentum around nature-based solutions, and why wouldn't we like that? Because it's nature, isn't it? And so forth. And yet, at the same time, there's vast amounts of money coming into this. There's investment banks, there's all these opportunities. EIB just wrote a big report. Rewilding is in it like 100 times or something. And, you know, money coming in, investors looking for financial returns, of course. Mm-hmm. And it ties in with a number of other trends we see in terms of carbon offsets. And even the most strangest and most paradoxical of them all, the biodiversity offsets. So these are trends that are manifesting now. And I'm just wondering whether you have any thoughts on what's happening there. Money coming in, creation of natural financial assets, you might say.
Yeah, generally speaking, I see it. I see huge dangers in that. I mean, obviously, if that is what's happening, to some degree, it's something we're going to have to work with. And there are those who would argue, well, why do you care if it's bringing nature back? What's your issue with that? I think there are multiple issues with it and multiple dangers that we need to be mindful of, or we will fall into very serious traps. And I guess, you know, if you peel back the layers, the real problem here is that the economic system that currently exists, which let's call it what it is, it's capitalism, is only interested in one thing, and that is profits and making money. So whatever it proclaims are its interests, you can be sure that it's untrue. That it all comes down to one thing, which is profits for shareholders, and everything else is just paying lip service to something else for that, to further that aim. And we can get a picture of that from the fossil fuel companies, for example. So, you know, they claim that they're interested in moving in different directions and you know, putting research and development into alternatives to fossil fuels. They really are not. Their interest is solely in carrying on what they're doing for as long as they possibly can. And the same psychology and the same processes are at play with whatever we're talking about when we're talking about investor-led change to anything. They will say one thing and they will do something very different.
They have our best interests at heart.
I'm afraid they absolutely do not. So, like, I guess it's worth teasing out what that means in practical senses. I think if you have companies, firms who are getting into biodiversity as a profit-making venture, they're not going to be doing it in the right way. And further, there's a huge danger that will push out local rural communities, because they will be driving up the price of land, pricing out the people who actually live in these areas. And if rewilding or ecological restoration comes to be associated with the death of rural communities and outside investors coming in and buying everything up, that will be hugely damaging and will have negative effects both for the rural communities themselves but on rewilding also.
Mm-hmm.
Because it will come to be seen as a form of green colonialism, and that will be an utter disaster.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah.
So, kind of moving on now to talk a bit about the future and what is going to happen to these ecosystems. Obviously, we want to talk about climate change. And I was wondering what you thought about how these native ecosystems like the Atlantic rainforest might adapt under climate change. And, you know, do you think, or to what extent do you think there might be a role for humans to aid this process of the adaptation to changes in climate?
I think there's definitely a role for people. I don't know about adaptation. I think more just in terms of what I was talking about earlier, which is, you know, undoing human damage. So where we have driven species to extinction, we should be looking at bringing them back. Where we have introduced species that are causing huge damage, until ecosystems reach a level of functionality in which they're able to start controlling those invasive species or those other negative effects that we have caused, we need to lend a hand in undoing some of that damage until ecosystems can handle those problems themselves. As regards your question of climate change or climate breakdown, that's such a huge unknown. It's really, I mean, I do think about what will happen if the amok starts to break down, and, you know, I mean, if that were to happen, you know, all bets are off. You can talk about temperate rainforest here, but, you know, if the climate is dry for half of the year and much colder, you know, you're not going to have the conditions for temperate rainforest. That is a huge worry. I don't know what we can really do about that except fight to shut down burning fossil fuels right now, which absolutely needs to happen. But just widening your question out a little bit, you do often hear people say, well, we should be bringing in species from here, there, or everywhere to kind of hedge our bets because we don't know what the climate is going to be like. I think they're absolutely wrong and mistaken. And the reason why I say that is, well, you can start by looking at the natural range of, for example, most of our tree species. So, like, if we're talking about forest ecosystems, sessile oak, downy birch, rowan, holly, hazel, most of the, practically all of the species that make up a natural forest ecosystem have a very extensive distribution that includes conditions that are drier, colder, hotter, wetter, you know, they can handle it. But the best way, what's going to be key to survival to their survival in the future, whatever happens isn't going to be factors like that. It's going to be whether they're integrated into an actual ecosystem or not. Because all living organisms are far better, are far going to be far more resilient if they're part of an ecosystem as opposed to something that's just plonked down. So if you go and get a species that lives in southern Europe, for example, and say, and you say, well, if it gets hotter, these species are going to be better able to withstand the conditions. Mm-hmm. No, they won't, because they won't be part of an ecosystem. They won't be part of the rest of the ecosystem that's here, because we'll have taken them from all of the other thousands of species that make up the ecosystem within which they co-evolved, and we'll have plonked them down in something that's completely alien. So they won't be integrated the way the sessile oak or the downy birch is. So we really need, and it all comes back, for me, it all comes back to one central idea, which is very, very simple, which is that we have to start placing our trust in functional native ecosystems again. And I cannot make it simpler than that. Mm-hmm. Both in terms of combating ecological and climate breakdown, and in terms of surviving and being more resilient in the face of what's coming down the tracks.
Yeah. Very interesting. So I'm just wondering, what's next for you now here in the farm, in the forest? Have you any projects that over the next few years that are on your mind? And I maybe also, we didn't talk about that, but activism. You've spent a lot of time. Your book is a beautiful book, and must read this. And you've spent a lot of time talking to people, communicating with people, and presumably you're getting a great appetite. People are interested. They want to know. It's a bestseller book. People are engaged in a way. And is this something on your mind? You think about this as well, the way communicating the ideas behind rewilding and trying to generate change?
Yeah, there's been a massive reaction to the book. I mean, already before the book came out, I was starting to get a lot of interest from diverse quarters, but that has grown exponentially since the book came out.
Yeah.
And I'm really, really pleased with that, because that's why I wrote the book, was to try to get across some of the kind of ecological messages that we've been discussing here. Because I think Ireland is in such desperate need of that. And one of the problems is that there's very little happening here that people can look to. So, for example, that people can look to as an alternative to the way things are. So, for example, I was invited to Scotland there only a few weeks ago to give a talk to a rewilding group that's not very old. It's called the Northwoods Rewilding Network, and it was set up only about two and a half years ago, to provide a kind of a structure for people who are practicing rewilding within certain parameters in Scotland. So you can be a part of it if you're rewilding over 50 acres but less than 1,000 acres. So it's within a kind of a certain band of people who are doing rewilding. And the objective was to have around a dozen members after a couple of years. They have 62 people within them now after only a couple of years. By contrast, Ireland, and that's, as I say, that's not all rewilders in Scotland. That's just people who are within those two
boundaries.
Yeah. So there's lots of much bigger stuff happening. People rewilding 60, 70,000 acres all across Scotland. In Ireland, there's virtually nothing. you know. So a lot of that has been focused on me because there's so little else that people can turn to for an alternative. And I'm happy to try to do my best, and all I can do is my best to be a kind of a lightning rod for some of that. I think in 5 years' time, the landscape in Ireland will be very, very different, both in a physical sense. I think there'll be a lot more people doing all sorts of different things in terms of rewilding and other forms of land use that are much better for nature. But I think also we'll be in a very different place in terms of the conversations we're having and the level of ecological literacy and just psychologically generally. We will look at land in a very different way, and we will look at our relationship with land and with nature in very, very different ways. There'll be far more engagement, I think. And that is so desperately needed. It can't come fast enough.
Yeah. That's a great vision. Work to be done. And thank you so much for your time today and sharing the great work you're doing, pioneering work and really important work. And I wish you all the best with it ongoing.
My absolute pleasure, Fergal and Catherine. Thank you. Thank you for coming and talking to me.
If you enjoyed today's discussion, we recommend you check out and support the work of Client Earth. Client Earth is an environmental law charity with a unique approach, using the law to create powerful change that protects life on Earth. To meet the global challenges facing our planet, Client Earth uses the power of the law to change systems for lasting change, informing, implementing and enforcing law and advising decision makers. Client Earth believes that a future in which people and planet thrive together isn't just possible, it's essential. You can find out more at clientearth.org. Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. It would be great if you could leave a review and share the podcast on social media. You can sign up at iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.